I wanted to share first that one of the reasons I was so happy about this conference was that I last year was reading an essay in First Things called The Civic Project of American Christianity, How the Public Significance of Christianity is Changing. And I was reading this thinking, who wrote this thing? And I saw it was Michael Hanby. And I was thinking that in a good way, because it's such a powerful essay. It's a very powerful piece. And I urge you to read it. It also prompted very interesting responses from George and Rod Dreher, and was much discussed. So if you have not read that 2015 essay, please do. Michael Hanby is also one of these resumes that is so impressive that all I did was cut things out of it. Associate Professor of Religion and Philosophy of Science at the Pontifical John Paul II Institute for Studies on Marriage and Family at the Catholic University of America. He has studied at a long list of universities. I'm assuming that he passed them and wasn't just thrown out. Okay. He's written widely in the areas of systematic and philosophical theology, philosophy of science and biology, and political theory. And he is the author of two books, Augustine and Modernity, and No God, No Science, Theology, Cosmology, Biology. In all, he's intimidating the heck out of me already, and I'm going to give the floor to him.
I'm not sure where this thing ought to go. Well, so now for the bad news. Following on everything else we've heard. I'm a little bit concerned about the time. I keep thinking of things, more things that I want to say. So in order to shave off a few minutes, I just want to say a very general, but nonetheless sincere thank you to everybody who put this together. And I'm honored for the invitation and very grateful to be here. The future of Christianity in America is perilous. By perilous, I do not mean hopeless. More than once in the history of the church, perilous times have proven to be occasions for purification and renewal. We should cling to this hope, and we should work tirelessly for it. But the realism of our hope and the efficacy of this work hinge on our not confusing hope with optimism. Fortunately, that's something I'm rarely accused of. It should be clear to anyone with eyes to see and ears to hear that we are living through some sort of profound cultural and social revolution, concentrated on those areas of life that cut closest to who we are as human beings. That this is apparently not clear to so many of our contemporaries is a profound testament to the grip that liberal public reason and the prevailing order of pragmatism has on our imaginations, and really just to the pervasive thoughtlessness of our culture. In reducing questions of truth to contests of right, liberal order seems largely to have succeeded in concealing this revolution from view. So while we have preoccupied ourselves with fighting for our dwindling place in the public square, the state has fundamentally redefined human nature under our noses, with nary a word from the church or from Christian intellectuals who appear mostly not to have noticed, although it's becoming harder not to notice. It takes a real effort. Indeed, Obergefell effectively obliterates the category of natural relations altogether, leaving us with mere legal relations, now the only real relations, plus biology, an unreal abstraction from the real order of creation and nature. And this opens the doors to all sorts of unanticipated mischief that we ought to begin anticipating. Nevertheless, seen or unseen, the revolution is upon us. What previous generations have taken for granted, for example, that man, woman, mother, and father name natural realities as well as social roles, that children issue naturally from their union, that the marriage of man and woman is the foundation of human society and the optimal home for their flourishing, all this is now regarded as obsolete and even hopelessly bigoted, to be replaced by new archetypes whose institution will require the purging of language and a concerted effort at stupefaction. Thankfully, we have modern education and a global media echo chamber, now worn as a prosthetic attachment, each rigorously committed to not thinking about the fundamental questions of human existence. This revolution will require new rights and a new morality, rigorous policing of the bounds of acceptable thought and speech, and new mechanisms of surveillance and enforcement for punishing bigoted transgressors of the emerging orthodoxy by both legal and extra-legal means. This seems to me inevitable. We cannot tamper so deeply with fundamental human realities without affecting everything else besides. And it is naive to think that a dose of live and let live tolerance, or even juridical protection, will suffice to curtail the forces which this revolution has set in motion, and which cannot easily be recalled or contained within the scope of law. As a brief and rather superficial example of what I mean, consider that impressive show of force that crushed Indiana's RFRA legislation and made the previously unknown owners of Memory's Pizza in Walkerton, ordinary folks seemingly minding their own business, into international villains. To my mind, the most stunning thing about this is not the sudden shift in public opinion or the new alliance between big business and progressive politics, arguably the historical norm rather than the exception, but the bare fact that it is now possible to amass and exert such force almost instantaneously, prior to and independent of any decision of the law. Who needs a Stasi when you have a neighbor with an iPhone handy and handy access to Twitter, ready to destroy your life in an instant? It's not clear to me what protections the courts could have provided, had they been so inclined, or that any amount of goodwill would have sufficed to tame the furies once they were unleashed. This episode and others like it, besides making visible a new kind of power that we do not adequately understand, are evidence that the America many of us have taken for granted no longer exists or is rapidly disappearing. Though there were always problems and ambiguities in America's founding political philosophy, most of us have assumed that America's deep roots, deep historic roots in the Christian West, made it naturally hospitable to the principles of Christian morality, and that it even secured the political conditions for the flourishing of the church, which would act, for its part, as a kind of moral leaven for civil society. In retrospect, we can see that there was a great cost, though hidden, to this assumption, as our efforts to Christianize liberalism ended up liberalizing Christianity. But the bygone age of brick-and-mortar Catholicism shows that this was true in a certain empirical sense. Catholics could feel genuinely at home here, and we thought we could fulfill our duty to serve the common good simply by being good citizens and being morally upright. Whether or not this was ever true, this dream now seems to be coming to an end. And despite the many problems inherent in our defense of religious freedom, the end of this dream almost certainly means the erosion of religious freedom as we have known it in America and, in fact, throughout the West. In the coming years, Catholics will find themselves under enormous pressure from an anti-Catholicism different in kind from the earlier forms born out of the theological conflicts of the Reformation. Generations of cultural assimilation and comfortable living have not prepared us for this, in mind or in heart, or in our deeply compromised and sometimes decaying institutions. And as clear as it is that we are undergoing some kind of cultural revolution, it's just as clear that this revolution is not external to the life of the church, as you will have surmised if you've been following events of the last couple of years. And for every Catholic who is anxious about the looming threat of religious freedom, there seem to be at least two who cannot imagine that their religious freedom is something that they might ever need to exercise, and who are only too eager to scoff at the persecution complex of their less sophisticated brethren. The situation reminds me of a great scene from one of my favorite films, the Coen brothers' Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, where the young Tommy Johnson, who sold his soul to the devil in exchange for mastery of the blues guitar, is asked by the simpleton Delmar, incredulously, how he could sell his ever-loving soul to the devil. Johnson replies unhesitatingly and with equal incredulity, "Well, I wasn't using it." An apt image, I think, of much of contemporary American Catholicism. All of which is to say, that as we face enormous pressure from without and decay and capitulation from within, we are in for a deeply confusing time, a time of winnowing, perhaps. And the future of authentic Christian existence is uncertain. It will be less certain still unless we come to a deeper understanding of the present moment and the kind of purification required of us. And yet I think, as Americans, we may be peculiarly unequipped for this. Despite our native suspicion of political power, Americans believe deeply in politics as such. This is due, I think, to certain assumptions about causality and history that are inherent in our founding, but also to the fact that we have no real common faith or history or culture outside of the decision to found the nation on 18th century philosophical principles. Indeed, the adjective American has no real meaning outside of this decision. And so Americans have always looked inordinately to politics and to the law to perform the work of faith, culture, and tradition in giving us an identity as a people. I think that's part of what we mean by continually referring to ourselves as an experiment or a proposition. Politics is therefore first philosophy for us. All real questions, in the end, are political. And this is a habit of mind that is reinforced by the liberal pretense to exclude questions of ultimate meaning from legal and political consideration. We don't look or think beyond liberal order because for Americans there is no beyond. There be dragons. Acquiescence in the priority of the political, then, places, I would suggest, a voluntary limit on how far we are willing to think, which then becomes an involuntary limit on how far we are able to see. And so we remain mostly blind to the forces deeper than politics which threaten our freedom. Indeed, to suggest that there might be forces of history besides those inspired by Adam Smith that govern us more deeply than politics or the rule of law is generally to incur an anathema sit and branding as a Hegelian traitor to the American tradition of thought. I'll cut right to the chase. What I want to suggest is that the sexual revolution is the harbinger, the human face, if you will, of a new post-political totalitarianism. Post-political, not because political order or political mischief is at an end, or because there is not a political dimension to this revolution, or because politics is no longer important. None of this is true. But because liberal political order is itself reactive to, and indeed the instrument of, exigencies which it helped to unleash, but which it cannot finally govern. These exigencies are fundamentally technocratic or technological in nature and are essentially absolutist, which is to say that the sexual revolution is at bottom the human face of the technological revolution and is perpetual war against the given limits of nature and indeed the given limits of every kind. The absolutism of technocracy consists not in the rule of one who consolidates all power in his person, though the Obama years have shown us that one technocrat can still cause a lot of trouble. It is rather the rule of nobody, not to be confused with the absence of rule. The mindless, inhuman rule of a complex adaptive system with no controlling center, no levers to pull, and therefore no real bearers of political responsibility. Technocracy is absolutist not because it dictates everything one can and cannot do, and in fact it generally perpetually generates a plethora of new private options succeeding or cascading on one another, but rather because it is the all-encompassing whole beyond which there is nothing and within which various options are permitted to appear. It relies less on the police power of the state and the coercive force of law than on unaccountable processes of bureaucracy and the overwhelming power of a ubiquitous media to mediate what counts as the real world. This is arguably a more perfect, if less violent, form of absolutism than any seen heretofore, for its mechanisms of enforcement are internal as well as external. In a perfectly absolute society, one whose rule was indeed total, no one would ever know he was being coerced. Rather, there would simply be truths that could no longer be perceived, ideas that could no longer be thought, experiences that could no longer be had, and no one would ever know what they were missing. This claim requires me to clarify what I mean by technology and technocracy, how we are governed by it, and what it means to say that sexual revolution is the human face of the technological revolution. Technology, in the sense that I am using the term, is not merely a collection of tools or instruments, neutral and indifferent in themselves, that can be used badly or well. Certainly various technologies can be used badly or well, and certainly we should subject these technologies to moral judgment. Any honest evaluation of technology must acknowledge with profound gratitude its innumerable blessings and the many ways in which our lives depend upon it. So before anyone invokes the argument from Leech's, yes, I am grateful for modern medicine. And in fact, to be perfectly honest, I was grateful for air conditioning before it was condemned. Even so, an evaluation of whether a given technology is good or bad does not tell us what technology essentially is. And so the point here is not to reject or condemn technology, which is impossible to the point of unmeaning, but to try to understand as deeply as possible what the essence of modern technology is, what makes it modern, if you will, and what it portends for the human future. I want to elaborate what I take to be the three essential and interrelated characteristics of modern technology in this sense. Technology as a way of regarding the world, technology as a tacit philosophy of being, nature, and human nature, and technology as a kind of fate, which determines the form and content of our thought and action, including political action. And I want finally to suggest that freedom from this fate, and thus the fate of a Christian freedom, more basic than religious freedom in the liberal sense, hinges on the recovery of something like theoria in the old classical sense of the word. The first sense of technology as a way of regarding the world is indicated by the term itself, which fuses techne and logos, making and knowing. The technological way of regarding the world, namely as an artifact to be worked upon, has been endemic to modern science since its inception in the 17th century, and it precedes any real technological products, the ordinary instrumental sense of technology generated by the new science. As the term indicates, this technological manner of knowing is a knowing by doing, which, quote, takes experience apart and analyzes it, in Francis Bacon's words, destroying in thought and experiments the unity of natural phenomena given in experience in order to reduce them to their simplest components, determine the laws governing their construction and interaction, relations which are the real subject matter of the new sciences, and to reconstruct them as the sum of those components and their interactions. Herein lies the key to the famous Baconian equation of knowledge and power. It's not that we simply know nature for the sake of control, as if every scientist were Goethe's Wagner trying to cook up homunculus in his basement. This is often true enough, but it's just as true that scientists undertake their work for noble and humanitarian ends. In other words, intentions are not the point. It's rather that we know nature now by means of the various kinds of control we are able to exercise over it. And the truth of our knowledge is precisely identical to our success in replicating experiments, in predicting, retrodicting, or manipulating these phenomena. This is why Bacon says that truth and usefulness come to the same thing. Corresponding to this subjective conflation of knowing and making is the objective conflation of nature and artifice, the second sense of technology as metaphysics and natural philosophy. For Aristotle and the tradition, art imitated nature, which meant that a thing existing by nature possessed something that an artifact lacked, or better, is something that an artifact is not. The distinction between nature and art signifies two different ways of being a thing. An artifact has entelechia and energeia. It has its being, its end, its purpose, and thus its own proper activity within itself. Whereas an artifact has its form and its being and its purpose imposed upon it from the outside and bears only an extrinsic and accidental relationship to what it is, to its own being and nature. A thing existing by nature has, or rather is, its own project, and so it has an interior horizon that an artifact lacks. That's why it's like something to be a bat, but not like anything to be an iPad. By contrast, an artifact is not its own project, but its maker's. Its being is instrumental. Though artifacts whose end is beauty rather than use arguably have a certain kind of in itselfness that a mere tool lacks. Well, beginning in the 17th century, the analogy between nature and art was inverted and finally collapsed. Nature itself comes to be reconceived as artifice, produced first by the gracious hand of a designing God, and later by the gracious hand of history or natural selection. And this transformation is why it's not sufficient simply to invoke the laws of nature and nature's God in trying to refute this or trying to come to the bottom of this. The artificial view of God and nature was built into the way that early moderns, especially in the Anglo-American world, thought and spoke about law and the laws of nature and nature's God. And I would suggest that our political order emerges in the midst of this massive transformation that transforms the meaning of teleology and law, nature, and as Bill pointed out earlier today, even creation itself. The conflations of knowing and making, nature and art, make the old distinction between contemplation and action obsolete, for the simple reason that there are no longer any depths to contemplate, only facts to analyze and synthesize. Consequently, a good portion of modern philosophy, particularly in the Anglo-American world, has sought to make the world safe for physics, either by supplying science with solutions it has not sought to problems it does not acknowledge, or by bringing philosophy itself to a suicidal end. Nothing succeeds like success. If manipulating variable X produces result Y, and if result Y further enables experiment Z, then the results validate themselves. It's superfluous to ask what a cause or understanding or explanation is, or even what X, Y, and Z are. In fact, strictly speaking, there's no room within technological reason for asking or thinking about what anything is. As John Dewey, founding father of American pragmatism and modern progressivism, put it, things are what they can do and what can be done with them. It's an astonishing claim when you stop to think about it, and it's astonishing for more than one reason, not the least of which is that if you think about it, there's a massive disincentive to understanding, or conversely, an inducement to thoughtlessness at the very heart of our prevailing form of reason. Little wonder, then, that there's simply no such thing as a profound question in American public life. It's just not a category through which we approach the world. There are problems to be solved, awaiting technical and managerial solutions. And little wonder also that we now know how to do things to ourselves and to our posterity that we have not the first idea of how to think about. What then of the third sense of technology, technology as a kind of fate? If nature is essentially a machine, or in contemporary nomenclature, a system, then the knowledge of nature is essentially engineering. The capacity to, quote, generate or superinduce on a given body a new nature or natures, as Bacon put it. But if knowledge is really engineering, then the truth of this knowledge is essentially whatever is technically possible. And since the ultimate limits of possibility can only be discovered by perpetually transgressing the present limits of possibility, the reduction of nature to art and truth to function commences an interminable revolution against the given limits of nature and against limits of every kind. A technocratic society, one whose basic conception of reason and reality are themselves technological, will therefore establish revolution as a permanent principle, paradoxically giving it the stability of an institutional form. The relationship between liberal and technological order, I would suggest, is more than accidental. Liberal order, as I see it, is the political form par excellence of an essentially technological society. Though I would not be the first to suggest that this is something that it shares in common with other modern forms of political order, often thought to be its antithesis. I believe this claim could be vindicated historically, though I recognize, apropos of Phil's paper this morning, that there are a great many ambiguities here that have to be sorted out. And this would be, in any event, a complicated business. It would require a careful sorting through of the relationship between 18th century natural philosophy and political philosophy. It would require factoring in the neoclassicism of the American founders. It would require factoring in the attempts of the Scottish Enlightenment thinkers who so influenced them to unite a Newtonian conception of nature and traditional morality, or kind of an Aristotelian sense of the moral life, by refounding it on some non-rational basis like moral sentiments or sociality. So I take your point about individualism. It would require a careful parsing out of the continuities and discontinuities between 18th century and 19th century thought. And it would require careful methodological distinctions in the historiography between, say, the sources and intentions of historical agents, the founders or whomever, and the logical presuppositions and relationships between their ideas, many of which they might not have been aware of. But I don't want to re-adjudicate the history, and mine really isn't a historical claim about the intentions of the founders or the sources of their thought, nor a political claim about the best regime or about how to save the republic, which is how this kind of argument is typically received, as a different kind of argument than what it actually is. Rather, it's a philosophical claim about the relationship that must obtain in principle between any political philosophy, any political order, and natural philosophy, and about the relationship between the liberal conception of freedom and a technological understanding of nature. However one resolves these historical questions, logically speaking, it seems to me that the concept of freedom enshrined in the modern notion of rights, even the negative rights, beloved by devotees of classical liberalism, is the counterpart to this view of nature. The classical and Christian understanding of freedom as enjoyment of the highest good was no longer really available after the 17th century. For neither the summum bonum nor the intrinsic teleological ordering of intellect and will could survive the banishment of formal and final causality from the natural order. Freedom thus ceases to be a perfection, the actualization of a potency given with our nature, realized in the enjoyment of goodness and truth, and becomes instead the capacity to act or to forbear from acting. That is to say, freedom, like truth and eventually nature itself, becomes a kind of possibility or power. Likewise, the objects of intellect and will cease to be intrinsic ends given with our nature prior to our choosing, and are reconceived as possible objects of choice. Now, Phil's right, we still have a moral obligation to choose one way rather than another, to seek truth and to do good, at least for as long as such obligations remain intelligible within a meaningless mechanical world, which was not that long. And so, of course, the founders distinguished between liberty and license. No one that I know claims otherwise. But this obligation is external to, and indeed very subtly in competition with, freedom as indeterminate possibility, which has now been put in tacit opposition to every form of givenness. Eventually, then, a life of freedom becomes a kind of rearguard action against all those claims which would threaten to define me prior to my choosing. To be free, I must perpetually show, even if I have to carve it into my flesh, that I am the owner of my body, that I am not the culture or tradition or another human being or God or even my own nature determine its meaning. A political order premised upon freedom as possibility exists, in effect, to protect us from all those prior claims which threaten our self-definition. And so it must insinuate itself, so to speak, between me and all of those realities which threaten to define me. It's in this way I would suggest that the liberal state comes to act as the mediator of all human relationships and becomes absolute in the very name of defending freedom. Except that this revolution, like most others in human history, quickly overtakes the revolutionaries themselves, so that finally even the state cannot contain the forces unleashed by it. Technology does not wait on politics, not even those technologies through which we now conduct our public and political lives. I think the RFRA example shows this. And I think it speaks to one of the important differences between modern technology and ancient techne, besides those already noted. Generally speaking, the artifacts of the ancient world can be characterized as monumental. Think of the Colosseum. And it's in virtue of their permanence, as Hannah Arendt notes, that ancient man could hope for a kind of this-worldly immortality. Monumental artifacts exert their causality like unmoved movers, communicating their form to the generations down the centuries who pass through them. In this case, they can be said to imitate an entitative conception of nature, nature whose primary sense is that of substance. I mean, now, certainly modernity has also produced its share of titanic artifacts. I mean, we're in New York, after all. Which seem to differ from their ancient counterparts in degree rather than in kind, at least so long as we're considering the end product rather than the manner of production. By contrast, though, to the extent that quintessentially modern artifice is still mimetic, it seems to imitate nature not as substance, but as process or a system. Either through the increasingly rapid cycle of obsolescence, where one technological achievement is supplanted by the next, or because the artifacts themselves are processes or systems with their own dynamic causal agency. But it's impossible in principle to foresee the end of a new process launched into the sea of history, or to control all of its downstream effects. And all the more impossible as our interventions penetrate more deeply into living nature. As Hans Jonas says, you cannot recall scrap populations. And in a digital age, and it's all the more impossible in a digital age, where the cause and effect trains set in motion by technology tend to multiply exponentially in all directions at once in a non-linear viral pattern rather than in a linear chain reaction. As our technological products extend their reach across time and space, and as their effects accumulate, this perpetual war on the limits of possibility takes on a life of its own. Its masters become its servants, and its exigencies determine the conditions of human thought and action. Control, writes Jonas, by making ever more things available for more kinds of uses, enmeshes the user's life in ever more dependencies upon external objects. There is no other way of exercising the power than by making oneself available to the use of things as they become available. Tasks for theory are thus set by the practical results of its preceding use, their solutions to be turned again to use, and so on. And so as these products and their exigencies succeed each other and accumulate, Jonas says, quote, the situation for later subjects and their choices of action will be progressively different from that of the initial agent, and evermore the fated product of what was done before. To better understand the power of this technological fate and how we might be free from it, which is where the hope comes back in, let's look a bit more concretely at how the tasks for theory are set by the practical results of its preceding use. In other words, how it is that technological exigency determines what it now means for us to think. The sexual revolution I claimed earlier is at bottom the technological revolution turned on ourselves. The technological revolution we now see is a metaphysical revolution. And therefore, the sexual revolution is not just a revolution in sexual morality or in jurisprudence, but a revolution in our very view of human nature and of what we understand ourselves to be. This revolution is technological in two ways. Theoretically, in that a mechanistic understanding of the merely biological body, plastic and manipulable, underlies the canonical dualism of sex and gender. Practically, in the fact that the technological dominance of human biology is its condition of possibility. Same-sex marriage would have remained permanently unthinkable were it not for the technological conquest of procreation. Posthumanist biologists like Lee Silver clearly saw this back in the 1990s. And it would have been impossible to imagine that a man might really be a woman were it not for the technological possibility of transforming him into one. And yet these technologically generated exceptions have occasioned a radical rethinking of the relationship between the affective and material parts of human being. It resulted in the invention of new natural archetypes and the tacit reinvention of the fundamental human realities of man, woman, mother, father, and child because of what we can do under lab conditions. There was no need to establish precise criteria for determining death within an instance of its occurring, until it became technologically possible to hold people in a kind of limbo and harvest their organs for transplant. The realization of this technological possibility has occasioned a controversial rethinking of the boundary between life and death, and in fact of the nature of life itself. Similarly, there would have been no need to isolate an analytically discrete moment of conception, accurate to the fraction of a second, from a continuum of events that include the embrace of man and woman, the new embryo's step-by-step development, his eventual birth, were it not for our ability to dissociate, analyze, intervene in, and manipulate the various stages of that process. Now, my point for our purposes is not to dispute the solutions to these questions proposed by any particular theorist, though I think all of them have their problems, but rather to point out that the question fundamentally at issue in every case, the truth of human nature, brings us up against metaphysical questions of the first order, and any attempt to get to the bottom of them requires recourse to metaphysical principles excluded by the pragmatic form of reason and the functionalist truth of technological and liberal order. But of course, these never enter into consideration, either because they have long since ceased to occur to us, they don't fall within what we think of as reason, or because including them means a self-imposed exile from the public sphere and from public reason, which recognizes only instrumental technological reason on the one hand and irrational religious faith on the other. What is excluded in all of these controversies from the public square is not religion so much, or faith. In fact, that's very useful for dismissing opposition. It's philosophical reason. It's reason that's been excluded from our culture. The situation, instead, in these and many similar examples, the conditions for thinking speculatively about the truth of human nature are dictated by the practical and moral emergencies generated by our technology. The situation demands a knowledge we can do something with, and this demand in turn determines the form and content of our thought. The possible thus becomes the measure of the actual in the sphere of nature. The good becomes the measure of the true in the sphere of politics. And in either event, we end up short-circuiting understanding and settling for truths that are just true enough to achieve some technical, moral, or political good. Until, of course, they're not. All the forms of reason at our disposal for thinking about technocratic society are generated by technocratic society. And so we tend to reproduce its problems in our efforts to overcome them. If that's not absolutism, I don't know what is. And yet, if our technocratic fate is a post-political absolutism, then it's clear that the future of freedom is more than a political problem, and it calls for a much deeper reflection than we are accustomed to giving it. Now, the political defense of juridical freedom remains indispensable, of course. But let's not delude ourselves by thinking it will provide us with more than a modest hedge against the cascading necessities of the technological revolution and the massive social and cultural upheaval that follows upon its perpetual reinvention of the fundamental realities of human nature. Nor is the legal protection of religious freedom likely to avail much for the substantial mass of our co-religionists who seem unable to imagine why they need their religious freedom in the first place. So how then are we to think about this? It was a persistent theme of the pontificates of John Paul II and Benedict XVI that freedom ultimately depends on truth. The point is classical as well as Christian. And it's worth bearing in mind that in the classical view, that the first and most intractable enemy of freedom was not tyranny, but necessity. The foregoing diagnosis of our new technological necessity casts a new light, I think, on this ancient understanding. A society that is indifferent to truth, or that reduces truth to technological possibility or to pragmatic function, cannot ultimately be a free society. For its members, unable to see beyond the imminent horizons of liberal and technological order, or to act beyond its apparent necessities, will therefore be at the mercy of whatever forces their powers have unleashed. Conversely, truth is the source of human freedom, because it enables us to see beyond the imminent horizon and its necessities, and to act in a way that is not determined by the results of preceding use. Truth, therefore, not only fulfills that essential dimension of our nature not shared in common with the beasts, for this very reason, it is the ultimate source of that mark of creation, nature, and grace that Hannah Arendt called natality. The shoot of green that springs up as a surprise in the depths of winter, the new little world that appears in place of nothing with the birth of every child, the capacity for a new beginning undetermined by antecedent necessity, which characterizes free human action. So here then is the point. The fate of Christian freedom hinges not on the actions of the state, which can neither give this freedom nor take it away, but on the renewal of the Christian mind. The purification required of us in this moment is intellectual as well as moral, perhaps more intellectual than moral. If authentic Christian existence, which is what I'm more concerned about saving than the Republic, if authentic Christian existence is going to survive here, we're going to need all the spiritual, moral, and intellectual resources that we can muster. Needless to say, this makes the growing anti-intellectualism within the church a deeply worrisome phenomenon. Whether it comes from the right and its disdain for impractical speculation in a time of moral and political emergency, or whether it comes from those on the left eager finally to move the church beyond intellect into what? Affectivity, moral sentiment, feeling, I don't know. As if the church got into this mess by thinking too much. Amazing. This is an enormous labor. The labor of generations, made more difficult by the internal decay of Christian institutions at every level, and their captivity to the tyranny of pragmatic necessity. Some of these institutions will have to be dramatically reformed. New ones will have to be created. Many probably aren't salvageable. But I think it's little use thinking about the institutional or programmatic dimensions of such a renewal if we don't first understand what substantively this demands of us. There can be no renewal of the Christian mind unless we can liberate our imaginations from the necessity of use and rediscover something like theoria in the old sense. Since this cannot proceed as if the last 500 years have not happened, this can't simply be a matter of philosophical archaeology. It has to involve necessarily a renewed speculative and critical engagement with the thought forms of technological and liberal order. But even so, only by just rediscovering true theory and the contemplative dimension of reason can we hope to discuss, to rediscover the usefulness, I said uselessness, of a truth good first for what it is rather than what it does. And only on the basis of a truth that is more than function can we hope to recognize, much less defend, a nature that is more than historical process, and a freedom that is more than the possibility of endlessly dominating and manipulating that process. This useless truth, by liberating us from the necessities of use, is the source of a freedom more basic than juridical freedom, even as it is the latter's condition of possibility. And even though it is likely to be without much political effect in a technological and liberal order that seems to have succeeded in inoculating itself against it. The freedom which truth gives, therefore, is not a magical and otherworldly escape from fate, like Aphrodite restoring Paris to his bedchamber, but is rather a freedom within fate, the freedom to make our fate a gift by suffering in witness to it. Thus, Benedict XVI taught us that, quote, the freedom of the martyrs, who recognize God precisely in obedience to divine power, is always the act of liberation through which Christ's freedom reaches us. It seems obscene, I know, to invoke the specter of martyrdom from within the relative safety and prosperity of the liberal West and all our privileges and advantages and comforts, especially at a time when so many of our brothers and sisters elsewhere in the world are dying for the faith. Perhaps it's the wiser course to abide by Wittgenstein's famous remark, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. And yet it seems to me that there's a peculiar challenge to Christian faith and witness in the fact that technocratic order diffuses its power quietly, almost imperceptibly, without spectacle or responsibility, bleeding its victims slowly through 10,000 bureaucratic paper cuts, rather than spectacularly with swords and lions in the Colosseum. Not the least of these challenges is the very real possibility that one's sufferings may be visible in a media-dominated world only to God. If a tree falls in the forest and the New York Times doesn't hear it, does it make a sound? The difficulty created by a revolution hidden in plain sight calls for a deeper understanding of Christian freedom, not a dismissal of it. We must come to understand the difference between proper Christian freedom, the freedom of life in the truth of Christ, and religious freedom as liberalism understands it. We need to understand more deeply the difference between religious freedom and the freedom of the church, which is neither the sum total of the freedom of individuals nor a gift of the state, but belongs to the very nature of the church as the sacrament of Christ and the sign of God's universal intention for humanity. And we need this not only for ourselves and for the coming time of trial, but for the sake of the world. For if freedom from the inhumanism of a technocratic fate depends upon our ability to grasp or to glimpse a transcendent horizon beyond its imminent necessities, then the renewal of true Christian freedom will turn out to be the key to the future of human freedom as such. In which case, it's not the pessimist who distrusts the promises and possibilities of the prevailing order that lacks hope, but the optimist who cannot see beyond them. Thank you.